My name is Jessica Yates with the International Security Program, and this is the second half of the interview with Mr. Franklin Miller on U.S.-UK nuclear cooperation as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Mutual Defense Agreement. I want to talk a little bit more about the origins of the dialogue that you initiated. You said that before it began kind of in the early 80s as we were going ahead with the Trident II missile and they had already bought the Trident I missile, but your words were they never wanted to operate an SLBM system that was unique. Why was that the case? Why didn't they want it to be unique?
Because of the tremendous cost and technical challenges of operating a unique system. They went through that with the Polaris system. There is a history, and I will give you what I know, which is sort of word of mouth. I've not really seen documentation on this, but I nevertheless believe it to be absolutely, totally correct. We sold the Brits the Polaris missile. In the late 60s, of course, the United States developed the Poseidon missile, and the Poseidon was a MIRV system, carried up to 14 RVs. MIRV technology was extremely sensitive. The idea behind the MIRV was that it was going to overwhelm Soviet ABM systems. When the British made an initial inquiry to buy the system, Kissinger turned them down, said the technology was too sensitive. So the Brits went off in a different direction, and instead of building a MIRV system to overcome Soviet ABM defenses, they went off and built an elaborate penetration aid system called Shevelin. Shevelin turned out to be very expensive. It was a cost overrun. When the United States finally came around and said, yeah, we had it wrong. You guys can buy Poseidon after all. The Brits said, thanks. We're happy where we are. So they stayed with the Polaris as we went through Poseidon, and then we started building and deploying Trident I. At this point, you know, Polaris is getting pretty old. So the Brits signed the deal with the Carter administration in 1980 to buy Trident I. Polaris is no longer in service with the U.S. Navy, and Polaris is beginning to have very significant failures. They're the kind of failures that we all used to talk about before Rumsfeld made the term impossible to say without a smile, and it was unknown unknowns. You didn't know what the problem was. The U.S. Navy offered to transfer large numbers of excess Polaris missiles to the Brits, but it wasn't any good because they presumably had the same unknown unknown problems. Eventually, the Brits ended up having to basically build a whole fleet of whatever it was, I don't remember the number, 60-odd remanufactured Polaris missiles. I think it was called re-engining. That's the technical term. People had to be called back from retirement to remember how the Polaris fuel was made, and it cost the Brits an arm and a leg. And so going in, I mean, they saw all this coming. They said, we want to operate the same system as the U.S. Navy. There were cost efficiencies because therefore they can share all the test data. So when we do a missile test, that the data from that test applies equally to the U.S. Navy and the Royal Navy's fleet of Trident II missiles because it's all one pool. I mean, there is no set of, they didn't buy a set of Trident missiles and take them back to Scotland and there they stay. There's a common pool. So all of the test data is applicable to the UK as well as the US Trident, all of the technical expertise that we have. So if we develop a problem with the Trident system, we fix it, and that applies to them as well. So there are enormous efficiencies for them. And so that's basically their position. Whatever it is, we are never going to operate a unique strategic system again.
You're describing these kind of enormous positive externalities in terms of the efficiency for them of operating a system that's the same of ours. Do we accrue any of those externalities, or could we factor that? Did that factor into the price that we sold it to them?
No, it did not. It did not. There are other benefits we get, and I guess you and I'll get to that later. But from a technical or economic standpoint, no. The only economic, it was a national security benefit. There was a question of research and development offsets, which had to be worked out as part of the Trident sale, but there were no dollar savings for us in any way, manner, or form.
When you say the benefit that we got, I know we're going to talk about the function of the UK deterrent later, but are you saying that there's a benefit, just the benefit to us was just having the UK deterrent, or was there also a benefit in having a UK deterrent that had the same system as us?
The former.
Another motivation for the bilateral dialogue was this internal dialogue that you described within the U.S. government regarding why the U.K. needs a missile that can fit 12 warheads. How was that dialogue resolved, and you know, why did they need a missile that could fit 12 warheads?
They needed a missile that could fit 12 warheads because they, with a limited force, needed to overcome the Moscow ABM system and to strike a set number of targets, the destruction of which they believed would have been so serious as to cause the Soviet leadership to think very, very seriously before striking the United Kingdom with nuclear weapons, or threatening the United Kingdom with nuclear weapons.
But ours only operated 10, right?
Right, but we have vastly more warheads than the UK does.
But why couldn't they just get more missiles that had 10 warheads?
Then they'd have to have more submarines. And, you know, this is a limited deterrent force. The UK has always maintained what's called a minimum deterrent. You know, it's sort of a, not really, but it has been described in the press as a counter-city strategy. Ours was a much more across-the-board strategy, which threatened all of the elements of Soviet state power. And so they're very different. I mean, ours was an extended deterrent that had to cover attacks against our allies as well as attacks or threatened attacks against the United States itself. For the UK, the minimum deterrent is, at the end of the day, designed to prevent anybody from believing they could attack the United Kingdom itself with nuclear weapons.
Just so technically, the subs have a fixed amount of missiles that they can have on them, but missiles can fit as many can keep going up inside the warhead.
Each British Vanguard class submarine carries 16 missiles. The U.S. Trident submarines carry 24 missiles. That's the largest missile-carrying submarine that we've ever built. So the Brits could have built a 24-missile submarine, too, but the number of warheads from those eight extra missiles was not cost-effective as they thought about what they needed. And the other thing was, you know, when they came to us, they said, you know, we want to buy the Trident II, and we said, okay, here's the Trident II. This is what it does. This is what it carries. And they said, fine, deal. So it struck me as fundamentally immoral, in a sense, to have changed the terms of an agreement once we were 3 years into it.
But I think as you described it, a large part of this dialogue internally was, well, what is the function of the UK independent deterrent? Ought we impose limits on the, you know, size, on how many warheads can be put on this missile?
That's part of it.
What were the arguments in favor of, you know, what were the arguments going back and forth, I guess, on that dialogue specifically, whether we should impose limits on the size
because,
of the missile?
Because we were involved in a negotiation with the Soviet Union on START 1. And START 1 was all about the number of warheads that could be carried on each type of missile, counting rules. And for a variety of different reasons, we wanted to keep the Trident 2 counted as eight warheads. And having made that decision for the arms control process and for the U.S. deterrent, the question was, did we then impose that on the UK, which, as you imply, would have infringed on the independence of the UK deterrent, because we would have said, okay, you bought something that could carry 12, but because of U.S. arms control purposes, it can only carry 8. So that would have been an infringement on UK sovereignty, as well as a reneging on the terms of the deal to which we had committed to the UK when we sold them the Trident II.
What was the Soviet Union's response to, did they feel that it was under start our obligation to sell them something they only had 8 words?
No, I mean, this issue was resolved only late in the START negotiations when both sides needed to declare whether they had any programs of cooperation or other arrangements with other nations which involved the sale of strategic nuclear systems. The Soviet Union came up and said it had no arrangements with any country where it sold strategic nuclear systems to any other country. The United States made a statement. Lytton Brooks read a statement to the Soviets, which was later enshrined in one of the annexes to the treaty. And in that statement, the United States says that it has an ongoing relationship with the United Kingdom to modernize the UK strategic deterrent, and that the UK forces operate independently and are in no way, manner, or form part of the U.S. nuclear deterrent. They are not counted, therefore, under START. And the United States maintains the right to modernize UK nuclear deterrent forces. You know, unseen are the words in perpetuity. So, you know, it was a very, very strong statement that said the UK forces are not part of START, nor will they ever be part of a U.S., Soviet, or U.S., Russian nuclear arms control agreement. And to your great surprise, you'll learn that statement was negotiated and worked out. It was worked out between Washington and London before we ever deployed it with the Soviets.
Was there opposition after that statement? It was contentious?
Not really. All right. I mean, the Russians know that the British system is independent. That's not an issue. They always try to drive wedges between allies, but when they hit such a very firm response, they backed off. It wasn't a serious gambit on their part.
This does, though, seem like an area in which the technical dependence of their system could, at least kind of in an abstract sense, infringe on the operational independence of the deterrent. I mean, all the interviewees are very, you know, firm in sort of driving home the distinction, even if they're technically dependent, they're operationally independent. But since, you know, we could have chosen to limit, since they're so dependent on us and how they deliver those weapons and what the warheads look like, we could choose to limit what the missiles and what the warheads are. And likewise, you said that we had to train them on how to operate a missile that could independently, with independent targeting capability.
They would have learned that on their own. We shortcut some of the training time, but that wasn't significant. But go ahead with the
question. Just even hypothetically, I mean, is this theoretically possible for the way that these sales go down, and because of the MDA technical cooperation that there is, that their independence of their system in terms of its employment is in some sense dependent on the United States?
Well, it is certainly dependent. If the Trident II missile developed a huge flaw, it would affect the UK deterrent. So in that sense, it is. I'm not sure that I'd agree, and I defer to others in the warhead business specifically, but I'm not sure that their warhead is dependent on ours. I think it is similar to one of our designs, but it is a UK design. And under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, we're not allowed to give them a U.S. warhead. As far as technical dependence and number of warheads, they could have gone into, I mean, if Trident II had been limited to 8 RVs from the beginning, and since that was the only new submarine-launched ballistic missile we were developing and deploying, the U.K. would have had to buy that anyway if they wanted to have a nuclear deterrent that was based on SSBNs. So, in a way, you know, they might have had to adjust some of their targeting doctrine, or they might have had to adjust some of their targeting policies, but it's not a big deal. You know, what I objected to was, in principle, the idea that a U.S.-Soviet arms control negotiation should necessarily limit the number of warheads that an independent deterrent force could carry. So it was a small thing. It's a footnote. It was never a big deal. But it was a big deal in the sense that, as we kind of asked each other in Washington, what was the rationale for U.K. numbers, not for the force, but for numbers, you know, we all came up empty, and we realized that our ignorance of UK targeting policy and doctrine was enormous, that theirs was probably similarly enormous with respect to the true facts behind what we did, and that there was, therefore, and there was, in fact, no dialogue at the policy level between NATO's two nuclear powers, which was a, it struck us as a very bad thing. And so we moved to change that.
A lot of interviewees, yourself included, have described the benefit to the dialogue and the partnership, sort of the independent voice and understanding how a relatively independent set of nuclear planners approach the same problem differently. How do, in your experience, maybe it's evolved, but how does the UK think differently about nuclear weapons? Even outside of, you know, the white paper, some of those deterrents are because their deterrent is different than ours in the way it functions in the world. But do they have a different philosophy about the role of nuclear weapons? And, you know, has that impacted the evolution of the dialogue?
I wouldn't say that they have a different philosophy in about the role of nuclear weapons. I mean, in both countries' cases, in both governments' cases, over successive administrations on both sides, the role is as a deterrent. In neither country, in neither government, was there any set of individuals who talked about using these as warfighting weapons. Now, that's not to say that they didn't have real targets, because you can't have a deterrent that isn't operational and doesn't have real targets, and expect that deterrent to be credible. But in the sense that both countries viewed them as deterrents against aggression, no difference. There were other areas where there were nuances. So, for example, deterrence means from the beginning that you have to threaten your adversary's vital holdings, vital assets, vital resources, elements of state power. The UK looked at things a little different than we did, and so we had excellent dialogue about the nature of the Soviet system, you know, what the particular leadership in power in Moscow happened to value or not, why we thought that, why they thought this, you know, so there was good dialogue about deterrent principles and what to hold at risk. They were also more advanced than we were in some research into the effects of nuclear weapons. The United States only traditionally looked at the blast effect. And we talked last time about the fact that the UK, for example, looked at fire effects, you know. So there were other areas where we learned things.
The difference in principle and this targeting and, you know, what you hold at risk, can you remember any kind of specific examples where they approached kind of the same targeting question differently in terms of, or they wanted to hold some, I guess maybe this might be too detailed.
Short answer one, no, I can't.
Yeah.
I mean, except again, given that they have a minimum deterrent, so they were threatening a different set of things or maybe a subset of things that we would threaten in our overall deterrent. And two, if I could recall anything, it would undoubtedly be classified.
That said, the role of, you know, this nuclear weapons exist to, you know, as a deterrent, but you've said before that a component to the UK deterrent is prestige and their standing in the world. Was that ever something that was brought up in the dialogue?
No. No.
Just sort of implicitly understood?
Yes.
Dr. Wagner spoke very eloquently about sort of the difference between, or the tension between the safety and security of nuclear weapons on one hand and their survivability on the other, in terms of whether, you know, in order for them to be safe and secure, you want to keep them centrally located, but for them to be survivable, or in the context of NATO, you want them to be, you know, deployed throughout the countryside so that they're survivable. I mean, is that a tension that you encountered in the UK dialogue or even in the HLG more broadly, and how was it resolved, or what were the prevailing philosophies?
Well, of course, it didn't apply to the strategic deterrent at all, because by being submarine-based, it was safe. With respect to the larger question of the, you know, tactical weapons, theater weapons, non-strategic weapons was the term we finally came up with. No, I don't recall any disagreements with the UK. Obviously, it had been NATO policy long before I ever got on the scene, or my British colleagues got on the scene, that there should be burden sharing and risk sharing in the alliance, and that burden sharing and risk sharing meant that all the countries were going to participate in the nuclear planning process, and that some of them would be basing countries. NATO obviously had procedures to take in the event that war with the Soviet Union appeared imminent, which would have included the arming of aircraft, putting aircraft on strip alert, which they had done during the 50s and 60s and I guess early 70s, and people even examined the idea of dispersing nuclear armed aircraft, but I can't recall any serious work done on that because of the threat from Spetsnaz teams. But no, I don't. There was no difference between us and the UK in that area.
The one source of tension that you recalled was the basing of the F-15E, I think it was.
Yeah.
How was that resolved? What did we end up doing and why?
We ended up withdrawing. There were two wings of F-111s in UK, and we ended up withdrawing one of those wings and eventually replacing the other wing with the F-15Es. Remember, all of this is occurring sort of in the summer. It starts off sort of the summer, it's in the fall. It's in the fall of 1990. And while we're doing all of this, the world's changing. And we're watching the world change, and we in the Pentagon, in OSD policy and working with Secretary Cheney, were ahead of that. I mean, the wall comes down, or the wall is already down. I guess the wall comes down in 89. The Warsaw Pact starts to splinter. It's quite clear that the Soviet forces are being withdrawn from the Warsaw Pact countries. We're adjusting our targeting doctrine so as not to target countries that are not occupied by Soviet forces. And so the military and deterrent requirement for three wings of U.S. tactical aircraft based in the U.K. Starts to look a little weak to us. And so we start to think, what are we going to do with these things? How do we start drawing our forces down? You'll recall that in the fall of 1991, President Bush made a dramatic initiative which reduced enormously our NATO's non-strategic weapons and challenged the Soviets to do the same, which they did to a large degree. In some areas they still haven't, but to a large degree. So the debate over three wings versus two wings versus one wing in the UK is all caught up in this. And as we look to the future and we look at the cost of maintaining the F-111 E's and F's over time, we decided that the best thing to do would be to retire the E's completely and close the base at Upper Hayford, and to replace the F's, which were at Lakenheath with the F-15Es.
What was the UK opposition?
It was finding another place in the United Kingdom where there were going to be nuclear weapons stored, you know, and there's kind of local opposition. And then I can't remember the exact details, but the one base that seemed most logical from our standpoint, from the standpoint of joint working groups, turned out to be located, I think, in or near the constituency of the British Secretary of State for Defense, you know, and so, you know, things get in the way.
You kind of described, you said that you were headed for, this question is more about, I guess, the HLG than just the UK, but you said when we were considering those decisions to modernize, I think it was the short-range attack missile mm-hmm. and the dual, or the two-launch artillery, that we were headed for a train wreck is the way you described it. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that Bush canceled the modernization and drew down the forces, which essentially held the alliance together on that one question.
Mm-hmm.
Was that was Bush's decision to do that because of opposition within the alliance at all, or was it just because it was no longer, U.S. unilaterally decided that it was no longer in our interest?
Well, again, I mean, you got to go back to the context. We were looking to deploy these things sometime in the early 1990s. Actually, there was a new warhead for the Lance missile, and there were two new artillery shells, and then there was the SRAM-T. Opposition to short-range nuclear weapons, specifically to tube artillery and to the Lance, had always been vocal in Germany, because it was quite clear that if World War III came, a lot of it was going to be fought on German soil. The Germans were quite well aware that if the Red Army came sweeping across the Fulda Gap, you know, the tube artillery was going to be used on German soil. And the Lance only had a range of about, 130 kilometers. And so also that was going to be used, you know, on the eastern part of Germany. So these weapons were never particularly popular with the German public and the German opposition. But again, as I say, the walls down in the summer, in the fall of 89, and by 1990, you're starting to see signs of breakup in the Warsaw Pact. And then, you know, we start getting announcements that Germany is going to be reunified, so you can't really be targeting Soviet forces that are in a reunified NATO member, even though the Soviet forces are there and have a departure timetable, but they're still there. And so with the crumbling or the beginning of the crumbling of the Soviet Empire, the rationale for deploying these shorter range systems started to look pretty weak. And then, of course, in the fall of 91, the Soviet Union, I mean, there's the coup, and a series of events are set underway which ultimately lead to the demise of the Soviet Union itself. NATO's making these decisions all throughout this period. The high-level group chairman at that time is Steve Hadley, and we've been wrestling with what should NATO's posture be, and why should NATO have nuclear posture be, why should it have these things. And we took the president's proposals to NATO, and as I recall, it was we were writing a report that recommended that we could do a significant drawdown of NATO's non-strategic systems. And I think that report, you know, obviously people are reading the report, they're reporting to their ministers of defense, and the ministers of defense reporting to prime ministers, so there aren't any surprises. And NATO defense ministers approved that report, I think, in the fall of 1991. The NPG, Nuclear Planning Group Ministerial, is held in Taormina in Sicily. And you may check my date, but I think the fall 91 NPG is in Taormina, and that's where we essentially sort of ratify this decision. So the president's nuclear initiative is consistent with the direction in which NATO's going. And we were careful to coordinate this with allies, that there weren't any great shocks and there was no significant opposition.
So there's kind of two forces. There's the weakening rationale and there's NATO opposition. Would the weakening rationale have been sufficient to make this decision? Or
the weakening rationale would clearly have been, it was the dominant force. I mean, you'll recall that NATO went ahead against significant opposition in some countries and decided to deploy the ground-launched cruise missile, the Pershing, in the late 70s. So, you know, the opposition, some of the opposition was real and some of the opposition was Soviet-inspired.
Right.
So the opposition, we could have made the decision to try to press ahead and do this at the risk of political division inside the alliance. And it might have come out that some of the countries would have accepted the new rounds for the artillery and some might not have. But in point of fact, the prospect of the Red Army sweeping over the Fulda Gap did not seem particularly likely given events that were going on
right
in Europe and in Russia.
I'm kind of interested in how that experience could maybe inform some, you know, present discussions about modernization. And the analogy may not be appropriate, but I just kind of want to see what you think. Do any of our current NATO allies have similar hesitation towards current modernization proposals, just U.S. unilateral ones like the, you know, RRW or Earth Penetrator? And, you know, ought those hesitations factor into our decision-making? Because, well, one thing I've noticed is that almost every, you know, reasonable thinker, I think, that involved in these issues has made the point that other countries' decision to proliferate is not influenced by the size of the U.S. arsenal. And that seems very true and logical. But that said, when you look at things like the 2005 NPT Review Conference, it failed in large part because the non-aligned movement opposition to U.S. failure and U.K. failure to adhere to Article 6. So, I mean, even if it doesn't affect their decision-making, you know, directly, do you think that U.S. nuclear policy could indirectly undermine stability by fracturing the sort of coalitions that are necessary to achieve our non- and counterproliferation objectives?
Absolutely not. The allies say, as an alliance, on RRW, first of all, I mean, thankfully, the robust nuclear Earth Penetrator is dead.
Yeah.
I mean, that's gone. The decision to go with an RRW is really not subject to Allied review. It's something that we as a nuclear power need to do ourselves. I don't contest your description of what happened at the RevCon in 2005, but I mean I have a very dim and extraordinarily jaundiced view of the RevCon and of the CD because of my experiences in 95 and 2000. My view is that most of the people who go to the RevCon and who do this work in the CD are professional arms control bureaucrats who like living in Geneva and who have very little to do with what their own country's policies are. In fact, their own country's governments don't really know what they do because it's not a central issue. And when we worked in 95 as a U.S. government to get the NPT made a treaty of indefinite duration, we took one look at what was going on in Geneva, and we said, "The hell with this! We're going to capitals," and we got enough votes that had it been put to a vote going into the review conference in '95, we would have won a straight up vote to extend the treaty indefinitely without having to go for consensus. So I think, you know, the guys in Geneva are a bunch of hypocrites most of the time, if not all the time. The other thing is the RRW has become a cause célèbre, and people say, "Oh, you know, if the United States goes off and builds another new nuclear warhead, it will encourage proliferation, or will not be consistent with Article 6." For reasons which just escape me, I don't see anybody making the case that since the Russians manufacture thousands of new warheads or refurbish, which means manufacture, thousands of nuclear warheads every year, that's endangering the NPT. No one makes the argument that the Chinese force, which has been growing steadily, endangers the NPT. But when the United States says it's going to build a new warhead with no new military capability to change out existing warheads, suddenly this becomes an obstacle to nonproliferation and an enticement or an excuse for other people to build nuclear weapons. I mean, there's no logic behind that at all. This administration did a terrible job of selling the Nuclear Posture Review and the RRW on the Hill. It did a terrible job in large measure because Rumsfeld told all the rest of us who knew how to do this to stay out because this was Defense Department business. Rumsfeld let this ridiculous idea of a nuclear Earth Penetrator go forward, which, combined with other things, made it sound as if we would use these things preemptively against deep underground structures. A nuclear policy of the Bush administration, which in fact decreased U.S. reliance on nuclear weapons, has been portrayed in public without effective administration response as having increased U.S. reliance on nuclear weapons. So, you know, I mean, this administration, thanks to Rumsfeld, badly bungled this the public presentational aspects of this. But I reject the idea completely. Our nuclear arsenal has come down dramatically, as have the Russians, as, well, in their own way, the UK's has come down fairly dramatically. Article 6 says that we will strive towards complete elimination of all nuclear weapons. It also says that the signatories will strive for complete and general disarmament. You know, there are arguments as to where the comma comes in and whether the two have to be in parallel or whether it's there's a sequential nature. But I don't see a whole hell of a lot of work being done towards general complete disarmament either.
Right.
You know, this is just a, this is an opportunity for people to beat up on the United States and for the Russians and the Chinese to sit there and encourage them to do so.
In fairness, though, Russia and China are not, nor probably should they be, leaders in the non-proliferation regime. The United States is the should be the if we are to make the assumption that non-proliferation is an objective that we're
no,
in favor
see,
of.
I
the United
think
States.
In fairness, I think the Russians have the most at stake at this point. I mean, the last thing the Russians need is for Chechen separatists to get a nuclear weapon, and God knows that there are Islamic. I mean, the Chechen separatists are Islamic, and there are ties with Iran and other countries. I mean, the Russians and the Chinese are taking a free ride on the nuclear proliferation issue. The Chinese came into the game, but only very late with North Korea. These countries have an enormous amount at stake. It's a lot closer from Russia to Iran than it is from the United States to Iran.
But they're not making those. Even if they should, they're not, and we don't have agency over their decision making. We have agency over our decision making.
That is correct. That is correct. But they should be leaders in the non-proliferation fight.
Right.
No question about it. I mean, the fact that we are leaders and that we're alone doesn't excuse them from failing to shoulder their international responsibilities.
Right. But I mean, taking that all into account and just kind of realizing that we can't change their they should, but we can't make that decision for them. I mean, even if Egypt and these other kind of intransigent, non-aligned states are wrong, which, you know, I think they are, they're making a big stink at these review conferences. I mean, do you think, should we just scrap the review conferences? What ought to happen to the NPT to maintain it?
That's yet another question. You know, there is this popular argument that says that the Non-Proliferation Treaty is in the interests only of the P5. And that we keep everybody else down. I mean, my strong argument is, and will continue to be, that the Non-Proliferation Treaty is in the interest of each and every signatory, because the Non-Proliferation Treaty prevents their neighbors from building nuclear weapons when they don't. It prevents all these signatories from spending vast amounts of treasure to build weapons that, in fact, might be used one against another. And so I completely reject the notion that the NPT is a gift that the non-nuclear states have given the nuclear states. In fact, if it were not for the nuclear deterrent of the United States, several of the signatories would already have developed their own nuclear weapons. I think specifically of Germany and Japan, and potentially Italy. I think there is a popular version of history here, which is almost impossible to correct, but I have never bought into it.
But I kind of feel like Egypt is coming to the realization that or at least they think that the NPT is no longer in their interest because of Egypt and because of, you know, United States' failure to live up to Article 6. How ought we convince a state like Egypt that the NPT is in their interests?
Have Egypt decide whether or not it would like to have Sudan and Libya have nuclear weapons? The neighborhood gets pretty damn dangerous if the Saudis. You know, if everybody starts buying nuclear weapons and the treaty becomes null and void, then let's see how safe and secure the Egyptians are with their own nuclear weapons.
How do we convince them of that? You know, it should be obvious.
Well, again, not in the business anymore.
Right.
Can't tell you.
Back on track to U.S. U.K. stuff. The post-Cold War changing nature of deterrence, was this a major focal point of the dialogue?
Absolutely.
And what happened?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, we talked about what NATO's strategic forces needed to do as the Cold War ended. We talked about how U.S. And U.K. views of the Russian government and what would deter the Russian government should it become aggressive. How we should work the deterrent problem. We talked about the possibility, however extreme, that separatist elements might take over an ICBM base in Russia, and what would we do with that? So there was a lot of dialogue back and forth that both sides usefully contributed to. And I think it enriched each side's intellectual capacity with respect to the changing post-Cold War world. Can I show you any decisions that concretely emerged from that? I can think of a couple, but I can't tell you about them. But it wasn't there was a very strong dialogue there.
When you say decisions, I'm kind of interested in that too. I kind of like you like walk me through how one of these television phone calls or the home on home visits go. Are there?
They're home on home.
Yeah. Are the decisions actually made at these visits, or is it more just talking about problems?
Well, it's talking about issues, but it's also framing up recommendations that would have gone to the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of State for Defense, and so. No, I mean, these meetings were not empowered. I mean, they were senior officials, but they weren't empowered to take decisions on the behalf of their government. Except, to help set the stage for a discussion between the two secretaries, or to, in the case of the UK rep at Omaha, to prepare the paperwork and to shepherd it through the systems. Things like that.
What do you think that? What would you say you learned in the 24 years in this dialogue? Whether it be specific lessons imparted from UK counterparts about nuclear planning or operations, or even more generically, what did you learn about making partnerships function?
I think what I learned is where I started this story about the fact that. Reading Neustadt's book on alliance politics provided the insight that just because we spoke the same language didn't mean that we necessarily saw things the same way, and that a constant and continuous dialogue between senior officials is necessary to ensure that you are up to date, you're current with what your counterparts are thinking, and that you have established a basis of trust that you can use to tackle issues together. And even then, I mean, there was the odd event here and there where we were separated not by a common language, but by different perspectives, the way we did things that came to light only afterwards, and then you can try and correct it. There was an issue with a big exercise in 1993, and even though we talked about it going into the exercise and talked about what we wanted to accomplish and talked about how we wanted things to happen, it unraveled. The Brits kind of went off in their own direction. And as we put the pieces back together, what became clear was that while we had talked about it at our level, when the Brits played the game, which was to say they played it at the level of their chiefs of staff and the senior civilian in the Ministry of Defense playing the role of the Secretary of State for Defense, those key individuals played it in real time. They did not have, we had an Olympian view. We kind of gamed this thing out from start to finish, and all of our players knew what we wanted to accomplish when. The UK participants were playing the game as if it were real. And they hadn't been briefed on, this is what we want to accomplish, Minister. So it just went off track. And you learn these things. I mean, they're just cultural differences, little footnotes. So you've got to work at it. You've got to call people up. You've got to talk to them. You've got to listen to them. More than anything else, you have to listen. You cannot be in broadcast mode all the time. And that's critical to any relationship, whether it's a marriage or whether it's a relationship between two U.S. government agencies or with your foreign counterparts. I mean, you've got to talk to people, you've got to listen to people, and you've got to reach out. And as America, as, if you will, the putative leader of the NATO alliance, we've got to do the reaching. People will reach out to us when they've got problems. And they will always find us receptive because we're the leader. But if we only reach out to people when we've got problems, you know, it's not going to be the same thing. So you've got to establish the bonds and the trust and the intimacy, which then allow you to go on and work problems together. And when you start with that premise, you rapidly find, particularly with some of the smaller countries, not the UK, that what started out as a nuclear policy dialogue quickly grows to be a defense policy dialogue, because the people you're dealing with obviously do both things, and because you've now established the bounds, not the bounds, the bonds of trust that allow you to say, you know, we've been talking nukes, but I've got this other issue over here. I don't know what to do with them. So it's it was interesting.
Very fascinating.
You were knighted on behalf of your contribution to the relationship?
It's an honorary knighthood because I'm American, but yes, I was.
Okay. What was that for specifically?
Well, the citation, as it appears publicly, only says for contributions to UK-US relations. And that's all anybody's ever said. So, you know, we can all infer that it has to do with all of the work that I did together with the UK in this area and in building the nuclear relationship and over all these years. But they don't tell you.
Pretty flattering, nonetheless.
Oh, it was cool. It was very cool. It was very cool.
How did that happen?
Well, I got a call from the British ambassador. I actually was traveling. I was in Tokyo. And the one call I got on my rented cell phone during my time in Tokyo was from the British ambassador here, who said, I have wonderful news. And he said, you know, you've been given an honorary knighthood. And then it appeared on the Foreign Office website a couple of days later. There were three people in December of 2006 who received honorary knighthoods, three foreigners. It was me, it was Bono, and it was, I guess he's the head of Toyota. Not a Japanese individual. And after a couple of months, the embassy let me know that the Queen, when she was coming here for the celebrations in May, wanted to present the award to me. So there was a little private ceremony where I was presented the insignia of the order by Queen Elizabeth. So it was all very, very cool. It was very cool.
Was Bono there too?
No. In each country it's kind of done differently, but it's generally done by the British ambassador in that country. And so he received his from the British ambassador to Ireland. And the other guy was Carlos Carlos, who's the head of Toyota.
Yeah.
It also allowed us to know what Bono's real name is, because it was on the... I mean, they don't list him as Bono. List him as Paul Hewson.
Oh, okay.
H-E-W-S-O-N. So if you ever want to know what Bono's name is for Jeopardy, there you go.
This question might be kind of hard, but I'm kind of wondering if this dialogue had never been created... how do you think the U.S. and U.K. deterrence would have evolved differently over the past 24 years, if the dialogue in the one that you created in the early 80s?
It's a great question. I don't know really how to answer it, because it's hard to undo history. I suspect that our policies may have been less coordinated. I suppose that our own leadership role within the alliance might have been more difficult. I suspect that the sophistication of our thinking and British thinking about deterrence might have been somewhat less because of the lack of mutual interaction. But before we started the policy dialogue, there was a close technical cooperation in the world of the MDA, so both on the nuclear warhead side and on the Polaris Sales Agreement, SLBM, and related systems side. So again, I mean, I think it would have been a world of lost opportunities, but I can't tell you exactly what they were. But again, I mean, and it goes back to your question of a few minutes ago. It is certainly true that because of the friendships and ties and relationships and trust that we built up over time, in areas that had nothing to do with nuclear policy, we were able to reach out and touch Brits, and they to us, and solve things that I can't even remember, but you know, odd problems here, there, and everywhere that in the course of day-to-day business of running a defense establishment.
What's kind of interesting about that is that a lot of other interviewees have said the technical bonds that were created because of the MDA that preceded the dialogue that you started helped create or kind of forge the connections that translated into this operational dialogue. Last time I asked you that question, you said you did not think that was true.
I still don't think it's true because, and again, I'm not blowing my own horn. It's not my style. The MDA was, what, 58, right? I started building the policy dialogue in 82. So the MDA is around for a long time. Polaris sales agreement is 62, you know. So again, I mean, that's 20 years. No one had picked up that ball and run with it. So absent the MDA relationship and a Polaris sales agreement, it would have been more, necessary but not sufficient. Would have been more difficult to start a policy dialogue.
Yeah,
but you're exactly right. Necessary but not sufficient.
Okay. That might be what they're saying then. They're certainly not saying sufficient. I think they're just kind of saying it was a necessary foundation for, like, the...
Yeah, I don't even know that it was necessary, because in the course of my, you know, time as chair of the HLG from 96 to 2000, we certainly established much stronger relationships with the ministries of defense and a lot of NATO members with whom we didn't have PSAs and MDAs. So, you know, policy dialogues kind of live on their own. So, useful, but not critical in either event.
A lot of interviewees, especially in the scientific community, have described this real enthusiasm amongst the scientists towards cooperation and exchanging ideas with sets of people that think differently mm-hmm. than you, and how that sort of drives a bond that, you know, transcends borders, so to speak. And in some sense, the policy decisions to expand cooperation were motivated bottom up by the scientific community's desire to cooperate more. Do you think...
Really?
Well,
Not almost, in my time.
No?
Not in my time.
Okay. Well, some people definitely describe that just in the scientific realm.
Yeah,
not the operational realm.
From 58 to 82, I'm prepared to accept that that was the case.
Okay, yeah, it probably was. But my question then is whether you witnessed that same dynamic in the policy field, whether you were driven to cooperate in a sense just by how much you enjoyed interacting with those people and exchanging concepts with them apart from the benefit to our national interest, whether that alone drove and sustained the dialogue.
No. I mean, I certainly forged many close friendships which continue to this day. But if we didn't have anything to talk about, we wouldn't have met as regularly, and we wouldn't have addressed the issue. Yeah, I mean, there were some people who were pains in the rear end, but most of the folks we met with were terrific individuals. And we loved getting together with them. But I had lots of Allied counterparts, and I didn't meet with them regularly every six
right.
months and call them on the phone. You know, some I did, but not all. But no. No, I wouldn't have said so.
Kind of have a few questions about the future of the dialogue. UK officials are, you know, increasingly becoming a little bit more vocal in an anti-nuclear stance. And while I suppose a lot of this will depend on who takes office in the U.S. in 2009, assuming that the United States does not unilaterally decide to adopt the same stance and the U.K. continues in that direction, will that issue cause a rift in the alliance, or will their position influence ours, or vice versa? Or are these sort of meta-doctrinal issues too rooted in national interest and domestic factors to be influenced by the dialogue?
They are meta-domestic issues, but again, they have to be parsed very carefully. as to what direction, you know, who's going in what direction. I mean, Secretary of State for Defense Des Brown's speech last week, for example, to the CD. If I recall, you don't see the word trident in there at all. You don't see the word deterrence in there at all. A different Secretary of State for Defense with a different Prime Minister might have written a different speech. But always remember that the speech on which it's based, which is the one done by the Foreign Secretary, Margaret Beckett, a year ago, said, "We the UK strongly and deeply and passionately believe in the ultimate abolition of nuclear weapons. But oh, by the way, as a temporary way station, we're buying, you know, new SSBNs and new missiles, and we'll have them out till 2050 or 2060. So, you know, you gotta look at the context and read the words carefully. I don't see, and you didn't see the Bush administration come out of the box and criticize Des Brown's comments. So, you know, unless there is a radical turn, unless the British government decides to cancel Trident, which it's perfectly, you know, independently capable of doing, I don't see the two sides moving apart on nuclear issues. And in fact, even if they did, you know, life would go on. We still need the United Kingdom. The United Kingdom still needs us. But your question was very good in pointing to the domestic context and the international political context. And again, it's there's sort of watch what I do, not what I say kind of routine as part of it.
That's fair.
How do you witness the or how do you envision the dialogue evolving? And what advice do you have for policymakers and diplomats that are tasked in the future with maintaining the nuclear relationship?
Well, I hope it continues as we have laid the foundations. But I mean, the advice goes back to what you and I discussed a few minutes ago. You know, you've got to reach out, you've got to touch, you've got to reach out and touch, and you've got to listen. You've got to treat your friends and partners with respect. And you've got to stay in close contact. And if you do that, things should work out.
Now I'm going to argue with you a little bit.
Okay.
This is kind of a long question, but I want to ask about the function of the UK deterrent more specifically. I think it's definitely been the weakest part of all of the interviewees' answers, but maybe that's just my perspective. But as I see it, I think there are four major arguments that have been advanced by you and others about the function of the deterrent. From the UK side, I see sort of two. One is prestige and their kind of international standing. But I'm wondering whether we really want to be advancing the message that, you know, having a nuclear arsenal enhances the credibility and prestige of a state, whether that's good.
That's up to the UK to advance if they – and then they don't. The white paper really doesn't say that.
Right.
Okay, but so then as a reason, it just doesn't seem
that's
that credible.
That's an analytic answer, not a policy answer.
Right. The second would be their national defense, but – there is no scenario in which the UK would need to use a nuclear weapon and the United States didn't. That dynamic would be even more true were the UK under our nuclear umbrella and had some sort of positive security assurance. From the U.S. perspective, the argument I see advanced is that sharing the burden of providing the NATO nuclear deterrent, but the nuclear component of the NATO deterrent is becoming less and less relevant as we decrease our numbers, and our burden is diminishing regardless of whether the UK plays a role. Then from the sort of global good deterrence international stability perspective, this is the argument you made, I thought was the best and definitely the most interesting. There's two centers of decision making, the Soviet example about how they, you know, one deterrent might fail but both would not. I'm wondering whether this is empirically true, whether we had sources that close to the levers of power in the Soviet Union that could attest to this actually influencing their decision making. Was there a case in which they would have otherwise, you know, used a nuclear weapon because they thought that the U.S. deterrent would fail? It also seems like sort of the central tenet of mutually assured destruction disproves that, particularly how advanced our radars are. Even factoring in the small chance that we don't respond, the cost that they're wrong. And they're likely wrong, you know, are prohibitively high because the magnitude of them being wrong, which stops war. And then, it seems a little antiquated. I mean, we don't face that type of threat anymore. The threat we face is much more amorphous and largely stemming from proliferation, which could be encouraged by having another independent nuclear power.
Well, again, could be encouraged by having another nuclear power. It's not another nuclear power. It's an existing nuclear power. And if you chart the number of nuclear weapons produced that's more U.S. example. Forget that.
What am I missing?
No. Well, first, what you're missing is you have made the assumption that historical change is irreversible. And there was a wonderful article, an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, I think it was within the last 10 days, by Robert Kagan. I think it was Kagan, who kind of said, hey, Europe, what are you going to do? Europe made the assumption that to decrease conflict and tension in the 21st century, nationalism had to be superseded. You had to build all these supranational bodies, and you would reduce the possibilities of conflict. Guess what? Russia's gone another way. You know, Russia has decided that the best way to cope with the 21st century is to pump up nationalism. So you have made an assumption that change is irreversible, and that is a reasonable argument. But if you are betting the future of your country or the freedom of the West, it's not one that you can make so easily and so lightly. And indeed, developments within Russia over the past several years, make it 4 years, give one pause. It is unthinkable, even in the context of the U.S. proposal to put a third ABM site in Poland, for officials in the 21st century, in a government of a leading country like Russia, to make threats about striking Poland or the Czech Republic or NATO with nuclear weapons. That's just not on. What's even more remarkable is that nobody in the Western press picked up on it and took them to task. You know, the assassination of Litvinenko, little bit of extraterritoriality there. So you can't necessarily believe that the possibility of Russian revanchism and Russian aggression is zero. That's number one. So, I mean, that's the whole context. If you accept that it's a nasty, dangerous world, states have long-range nuclear weapons. Governments are made up of people, and people miscalculate. And so I think the dual center of decision-making does apply. You know, do we want to believe, and do we want our allies to believe, that we would respond with a nuclear weapon and honor our pledge if one of our allies were hit with a nuclear weapon? Absolutely, of course. That's policy. But it's also true, and I'm not undercutting the policy at all, it's also true that will be a decision made by the President of the United States at the time. You know? So, for a state like the United Kingdom, which has its own nuclear deterrent, that's the insurance policy. You know, you cannot strike me with impunity. Actually, that's an old Scottish saying that's written on some of their coins right now. You can't strike me with impunity. I've got my own deterrent. Regardless of what happens anyplace else in the world, you cannot strike me without fear that I will strike back. So, your second and fourth questions are kind of, it's conflated in a way, because should Germany and Japan build nuclear weapons? No, they're living under the umbrella. There is a status quo there. But the United Kingdom has a different status quo. And in the eyes of many Britons, because Britain is engaged around the world and has interests around the world, not just in little Europe, there are scrapes that the United Kingdom can get into. And while not particularly conceivable, they might be scrapes that they would get into where we're not actually convinced that their side is the right one. You'll recall that, and again, this isn't a
nuclear... Not a scrape that they would have to use a nuclear weapon.
No, well, you know, this wasn't exactly a nuclear issue. It didn't rise to that point. The Falklands, where there was a lot of question as to which side we were on, you know, for a while, until President Reagan said, this is the policy of the United States government, you know, give the Brits anything they need. So It's not completely inconceivable. The other thing is carrying the burden. You took what I said a little too literally. Carrying the burden of being NATO's nuclear deterrent is an intellectual burden. It's a policy burden. It's an international burden. It's being the only guy at the CD with a nuclear deterrent, you know, because the Chinese and the Russians sit there with the third world and say what a terrible thing nuclear weapons are and what a terrible thing space arms are, you know. And so who's in the dock? It's always useful to have somebody else in the dock with you. And
does them having nuclear weapons really make them that more credible of a
person? Yes, in my judgment, and I think in the judgment of many, yes.
Because it would still have massive conventional superiority over...
Yes. In my judgment, yes.
Okay. I'm sorry.
No. I mean, and so, you know, the question of the burden is much more than providing target coverage. It's an intellectual and moral, yes, moral, and political burden that we, you know, are better off sharing. Could we do it ourselves? Yeah, sure. Is life easier as a policymaker? You bet. If I had an issue and I had an issue with the CD and I was dealing with it, you know, I'd call my British counterpart. We talk about how to do it together. And what could London do to help out? Or what could we do to help? I mean, it's enormously useful and helpful to someone who's operating in the world of government to have a friend.
But there are, I mean, it just seems like the marginal benefit of the UK deterrent next to the US deterrent, the margin is relatively small. Or it's hard to, it's
not,
hard, it's not
to the UK.
Right.
Not to the British government.
That's true. But, I mean, do you acknowledge that there is also a marginal cost to having another country? I mean, unauthorized use, theft.
No, not in the case of the United
Kingdom. Article 6.
Not in the case of the United Kingdom. Absolutely not.
There's no cost to their arsenal.
I mean, there's a cost to their defense budget. There's a cost to their national budget. But that's a decision they have to make for themselves. And they've made that decision. But in terms of risk of theft or risk of diversion, no. You know, and again, I mean, you and I have already discussed the fact that proliferation, this is an excuse for proliferation. It's not a cause of proliferation.
Yeah.
You know, it's a convenient dodge. I want to do this, so I'll blame the UK and the US. You know, where's the outcry about the fact that the Chinese nuclear arsenal continues to grow? And we're talking about the NPT. It's not exactly consistent with the NPT for China to continue to build and deploy numbers of nuclear weapons. Significantly more than they had 5 years ago and significantly more than they had 10 years ago. It's all relative, okay? But the NPT doesn't talk about that. The NPT talks about moving towards nuclear disarmament. The Chinese curve is in exactly the other direction. So, you know, there's a... Shockingly, international politics is not pure.
My next question involves a lot of hypotheticals, but it's... Kind of in light of this reinvigoration of this debate about the world without nuclear weapons, you know, obviously some very prominent and reasonable former and current government officials have promulgated this vision of a world without. Lynn Brooks spoke about it very well last time he was here. And I, you know, I'm sure that for very good reasons you are skeptical of this vision. But my question is, assuming that we as a nation and perhaps even as a partnership make the decision, maybe the next administration, that this vision is a good one. This is a vision that the United States, our country takes. Do you think that potentially eliminating the UK arsenal would be a good first step towards actualizing that world without nuclear weapons, given that the cost of reducing it are much smaller than the cost of eliminating, you know, making massive cuts or de-alerting the US arsenal?
I would think that from a British standpoint, the last British nuclear weapon should exit service when the last US nuclear weapon exited service, and the last French weapon exited service, and the last Russian weapon exited service. Because if you follow the logic for why this UK deterrent exists in the first place, then to say that, okay, as a gesture, we're going to get rid of it and ask everybody else to follow suit means that it's really not needed anyway. If I'm going to give it up, because the Russians are going to promise, the United States is going to promise, and the French are going to promise, the Chinese are going to promise, but not actually deliver, then I didn't really need it in the first place.
Or could it mean that you're making a massive, step towards a world that you want to create?
You can make those kinds of massive steps of faith, leaps of faith. In 1991, President Bush came up with this massive proposal to get rid of most of the short-range nuclear systems, theater, tactical, non-strategic. And President Gorbachev disagreed, and today you will find that the Red Army, the Russian Army, still deploys nuclear weapons. And you ask the Russians about it and say, we live in a dangerous neighborhood, we don't like our eastern border. It wasn't a treaty, it wasn't a commitment, it was a commitment, it hasn't happened. So, when you're talking about serious leaders who have to bet their country's future, that's the judgment call they've got to make. And if the issue is, we're going to do this so that the Sri Lankans don't develop a nuclear weapon, and we're going to set a great example, okay, again, that's why people get paid the big bucks to make the decisions. I find it not particularly credible and not very responsible. I mean, there was a recent article, I can't tell you who wrote it, but it was reminding all of us of the Kellogg-Briand Pact that outlawed war in the 1920s. And you look at the naval disarmament treaties, under which the Nazi Navy was built, because there wasn't verification, because they were able to build all these pocket battleships and evade all the rules. The world's a nasty place. There are horrible people out there. There are people out there who capture innocents and cut their heads off. Not everybody looks at the world the way we do. And we make the mistake, as good-hearted Americans, of often thinking that everybody, all we need to do is sit down and reason with each other, and it'll all turn out right. That's risky on an individual basis. It's very risky on a national basis.
Okay.
One more question.
Oh, sorry.
One more question.
Okay. Can I have two parts?
Yeah, two parts.
Okay.
Very good. Well done.
Okay. The first one is, my question was assuming that we have adopted this vision as a good one, and
but even they don't say that we're going to do it immediately.
No. But this, they shouldn't do it unless should exit at the same time that the French or the last French one, and the last United States weapon exits. That's not possible.
Russian one. Russian.
But that's clearly not possible.
Why not?
They
hold one Trident submarine with whatever it's got, 48 warheads. And then we get down to 48, and then they pull a missile, and they go from 48 to 45, and then they go from 45 to 42. You could do that.
Immediately?
You could do that, you could phase, if you came up with a phased plan.
It'd not be verifiable at the same time.
Sure, you watch the missile get pulled out of the submarine. If you're at the stage where you're prepared to destroy all your nuclear weapons, then you ought to have verification procedures where you watch the weapons get rolled into the hall at Aldermaston or Bergfield, I guess. And they watch it get taken apart. You could do that as long as you're doing the same thing at Tomsk or wherever the hell the Russian weapons are, and you do it at Pantex. You could do this.
Okay.
You could set up a schedule.
All right, second part of the question. Do you see, if not now, do you see a situation in the future where the security situation had evolved to the point that the UK ought to disarm? Or what would the security situation have to look like in terms of unknowns, in terms of knowing those unknowns, in order for UK disarmament to be a global or positive global development?
Yeah, it's too easy, because that's a question I can't answer. That's a question for London. I can't answer that. So at what point are you convinced that no country is going to threaten the United Kingdom in a certain way? And I don't know the answer to that question, you just don't know the answer to that question. When are you convinced that the risks to your national existence and way of life are such that you don't need to maintain this kind of a defensive arsenal? I don't know. And the other thing that the nuclear weapon did is the nuclear weapon changed the nature of warfare just the way Bernard Brody predicted that it would. It induced caution in the great powers' dealings with one another. And there were some pretty nasty episodes of brinkmanship during the Kennedy-Khrushchev period. But when you look at all the wars that occurred in Europe, say from the end of the Napoleonic era to you know, the World War II, and you look at all the wars that occurred in Europe after that among the great powers, now maybe, you know, the better nature of our, the better angels of our nature, whatever the phrase is, took over. But I don't think so. I think war became too dangerous. You know, and you start to look at things. We have countries like Yugoslavia that fall apart, and there is no restraint factor until NATO steps in. Again, it's a nasty, messy world. So I think that nuclear weapons have made war among the major powers too dangerous, and I think that's a good thing.